Hello and welcome to Social Justice Matters, the podcast from Social Justice Ireland. My name is Suzanne Rogers and I'm Research and Policy Analyst with Social Justice Ireland. We release our podcasts in three very different formats. We have our interview series where we chat to policy experts across a really wide range of topics. We have our 10-minute lesson series where we attempt to hit on the key points that we think people really need to know on a particular topic within that short time frame. And then we have our seminar series, which gives us a chance to listen back to presentations we've had at past events. In this particular episode, we're going back to our 2021 annual Social Policy Conference, which was on the theme of social rights for all, time to deliver on the European pillar of social rights. And this gives us the opportunity to listen back to Social Justice Ireland's paper, which was presented by economic and social analyst Colette Bennett. We hope you enjoy.
So I'm going to take a brief look at the Agenda 2030 issues in Ireland, concentrating on poverty and social inclusion, on employment, on education, very briefly on taxation, before considering some of the policies that are necessary to meet the challenges we face in the next decade. Sorry, hopefully you can all see that. So this table here obviously looks at key poverty indicators across the EU and those same indicators then for Ireland. So you can see, for example, the number of people in Ireland at risk of poverty or social inclusion reduced slightly from 1.05 million people in 2008 to 1.01 million people in 2019. The number at risk of poverty using the 60% of median income metric then reduced from 686,000 in 2008 to 245,000 people in 2019. But interestingly, while poverty decreased slightly, whichever of those two metrics you used, severe deprivation actually increased. So from 245,000 in 2008 to 267,000 in 2019. And similarly, the number of people in a household with very low work intensity increased from 509,000 to 534,000. So you can see while there were some improvements, there's still a lot of work still to be done. In terms then, the number of people in poverty is very much the same as it was a decade ago. Now, it did rise dramatically in the period immediately after 2008. And then from 2016 onwards, there was a decline in the level of poverty risk. Now, our analysis suggests that the income distribution effects of recent budgets, certainly looking at the period from 2017 to 2021, is in budget 2021, indicates that budgetary policy resulted in all household types recording an increase in their disposable income. And the larger gains experienced by welfare-dependent households explain much of the reasons why the levels of poverty and income inequality have fallen during those years. We obviously warmly welcome those, because our consistent message in advance of those budgets was to reverse the regressive policy choices that were previously implemented, and to prioritise those households with the least resources and the most needs. And both Tom and Seamus spoke about the need to move away from those austerity policies during a time of recession. However, the analysis also reveals that budgets 2020 and 2021 shifted away from that approach. So it risks the reversal of much of that recent progress in relation to inequalities. Following the last budget just gone in budget 2022 in October, we welcomed the €5 increase in core social welfare rates, but we were disappointed that it didn't go so far to benchmark social welfare against average earnings. In fact, the real value of core social welfare rates is set to fall in the coming years due to rising inflation. We had proposed an annual €10 increase over 2 years to meet the benchmark as a stepping stone towards the minimum essential standard of living. And failure by government to adopt that proposal means that the standard of living of many people, particularly those who depend on social welfare, will fall further behind the rest of society. Now, of course, poverty isn't just about social welfare dependent households. They're not the only ones that are experiencing poverty. And according to the latest CSO data, 5% of those who are employed are living at risk of poverty. So that's approximately 100,000 workers. Over time, poverty figures for the working poor have shown very little movement, reflecting a persistent problem with low earnings. And many working families on low earnings struggle to achieve that basic standard of living. With Budget 2022, one of the very surprising things that stuck for us was that government chose again to leave those on low incomes behind. So again, when we did our analysis on Budget Night, as a result of government's failure to focus on low to middle income households with jobs, a couple with one earner at €30,000 received an additional 39 cent over the previous two budgets. But even more devastating is the outcome for a household of four. So where there's two adults and two children with one earner at €30,000, they've also benefited by the princely sum of €39 over the government's two budgets. And that's clearly not enough to keep pace with rising, steeply rising inflation. Moving on then to employment. In Ireland, obviously, the COVID-19 pandemic has brought enormous uncertainty to the Irish labour market and consequently to many families throughout the country. The pandemic's labour market impact has been very uneven, in particular when it's judged across age groups and genders and sectors of employment. And furthermore, the uncertainty remains, and many of the challenges will only really, really reveal themselves as the pandemic's disruption recedes. And if anyone was tuning in to the Taoiseach's presentation last night, we can see that we are still far away from that disruption receding. Here in this table, here we're attempting to identify some of the labour market consequences of the pandemic by comparing the CSO data from the final 3 months of 2020 to those for the same period in 2019. And the table also includes the CSO's COVID-19 adjusted employment and unemployment estimates. So they represent the kind of the lower and bound for true employment and the upper bound for the true unemployment figure if we estimate or if we assume that both estimates include that most individuals in receipt of the short-term COVID-19 pandemic unemployment payment, which is due to wind down, would be unemployed, if the payment didn't exist. And what those figures reveal is the hidden reality of the pandemic's labour market impact, with pronounced decreases in employment and increases in unemployment. And these are in addition to the existing challenges we had pre-COVID of almost 140,000 people unemployed, over 100,000 workers underemployed, so that is they are working fewer hours than they want to and are available for, a declining participation rate and static levels of long-term unemployment. Moving on then in terms of the sectoral impact. Overall, in 2020, there were 6.6 million less hours of work completed, either through job losses, declines in economic activity, COVID-19 related closures, or reduced working hours and opportunities. However, again, the distribution of these reductions varies dramatically across economic sectors. So some areas saw small increases or small decreases, and these contrast dramatically with the reductions for sectors such as accommodation and food services, which saw a reduction of 53%, cultural and recreational services, a 36% reduction, administrative services, 34% reduction, transport, 13%, construction, 13%, and retail, 5% reduction. So the largest impacted sectors are frequently those that are identified as having a larger number of female workers and a larger number of low-paid workers. And that's evident when we consider that notwithstanding the considerable loss of hours, income tax receipts decreased by just 1% in the year to January 2021. So that indicates again that it's the lowest income earners who are most impacted by pandemic-related employment and wage losses. Moving then to long-term unemployment, it's important not to overlook the pre-pandemic labour market issues that remain. So long-term unemployment has been a major labour market challenge for some time. The number of long-term unemployed was 33,300 in 2007. It increased to over 200,000 people by 2012 before falling again to almost 37,000 in 2020. For the first time on record in late 2010, the labour force survey produced by the Central Statistics Office indicated that long-term unemployment accounted for more than 50% of the unemployed. And it took from then until late 2017 for that number to consistently drop below that threshold, reaching 26.5% of the unemployed in the fourth quarter of last year. Now, as this chart here shows, the transition to those high levels was quite rapid. And it's of concern that we might once again experience such a change. The experience of the 80s, for example, showed the dangers and long-lasting implications of an unemployment crisis that was characterised by high long-term unemployment rates. And it remains a policy challenge that Ireland's level of long-term unemployment remains high. And it's obviously a policy area that demands more attention. Looking then at youth unemployment. We can't obviously talk about unemployment and COVID-19 without talking about the impact it has had on youth unemployment. And here you can see again the CSO's unemployment estimates from March 2020 to January 2021 for those aged 15 to 24, those the youth unemployment, and those aged above that. So they provide two estimates of unemployment, a low estimate, which reflects the normal measure of individuals without work and who are actively seeking work, and the high estimate, which adds to this all those who are in receipt of the PUP payment at that time. So if all PUP recipients were classified as unemployed, the CSO's COVID-19 adjusted unemployment measure indicated that the overall rate in January 2021 would have been 25%. That estimate rises to 56.4% for those aged 15 to 24 years and to 21.4% for those aged 25 plus. So the data suggests the existence and expected future growth of a severe youth unemployment problem. There's also a suggestion of a greater number of workers in precarious employment situations. And again, we're seeing data from the CSO in relation to that. And the growth in the number of individuals with less work hours than they wish for or less work hours than are ideal for their family circumstances, as well as those with persistent uncertainties concerning the number and the times of the hours that they work, is a major labour market challenge. And it's one that may grow in the period ahead as things start to gradually return. Aside from that impact, the impact it has on the well-being of individuals and their families, it impacts their financial situation, obviously, and it adds to that working poor challenge that we outlined earlier. There are also impacts then on the state. So given that the working family payment, which was formerly known as FIS or the Family Income Supplement, and the structure of the job seekers payments, they tend to lead to government subsidising these families' incomes. So therefore indirectly subsidising employers who create this persistent precarious employment pattern for their workers. Moving on then to education. And you can see here, you know, in terms of education, this is an area where Ireland tends to score quite well on international indicators. And I'm sure that was something that was covered earlier on this morning. But looking here at early school leaving, Ireland has the fourth lowest early school leaving rate in the European Union at 5%. And Ireland ranked second in the European Union for the percentage of people aged 20 to 24 with at least an upper second level education at 94%. So this downward trend of early school leaving is absolutely welcome. So it's a great development and it surpasses the national target that's set under the Europe 2020 strategy. However, and there's always a however, according to the CSO, an early school leaver is three times as likely to be unemployed than the general population aged 18 to 24. Only one in four of them are in employment compared to the general population for that age group. And just under half, 47%, are not economically active. So a further report by the CSO analysed the outcomes for students who started second level education between the years of 2011 and 2013. And when comparing early school leavers to those who had completed their leaving certificate, the report found that just 43.8% of early school leavers were in employment, compared to 74% of their peers who finished school, and that the median earnings for early school leavers were €65 less than their peers, so €345 per week compared to €410 per week. So despite progress that has been made in relation to early school leaving, those figures, that data there, is a cause for concern. Moving on then to higher education. So we have seen that full-time enrollment in higher education has increased by almost 33% in the last decade to 186,890 students. And numbers are projected to reach 222,500 by 2030. An increasing population of school leavers then obviously demands that considerable investment is required to ensure that the higher education sector in Ireland can continue to cope. However, as has been said by other speakers, public funding for higher education in Ireland has been decreasing since 2009, despite those steadily increasing enrolments in both full and part-time education. In fact, the government's Parliamentary Budget Office, in a recent report on tertiary education funding in Ireland, estimates that funding per undergraduate student at full-time, part-time, remote and FETAC levels enrolled in 2019 was 50% lower than that in 2008. So that report presents a very clear and very detailed outline of the challenges facing the sector. And it recommends that any increases in state funding are accompanied by the recommended administrative reforms. Crucially, it recommends that funding be sourced from sustainable revenues to prevent that repetition, as Tom outlined as well, of the cuts to funding during the last economic and fiscal crisis and into this current one. Moving on then to lifelong learning. Access to lifelong learning should really be an integral part of the education system. It should address income and labour market challenges that some members of society face, particularly those I've just spoken about. Our lifelong learning participation rate is slowly improving, and it rose to 13% in 2019. Our national target is to reach 15% by 2025, as set out in the National Skills Strategy. As progress is being made, though, government should consider revising this target to reach 15% by 2021 this year and to reach 20% by 2026. And that would bring us in line with the European Union, which has a lifelong learning target of 15% by 2020. Those who are engaged in lifelong learning, however, are more likely to be professionals than low-skilled workers, and they're more likely to be employed in public administration, professional services and finance, sectors that are more likely to provide in-house training or continuous professional development, and that have policies for subsidising education than, say, the retail sector or the construction sectors. So employers in those sectors and those other sectors must be encouraged and incentivised to participate in the development of their lifelong learning strategies, because that supports both the development of the employee and it contributes to the retention rate and obviously then the effectiveness of the business, which in turn reduces the costs associated to that business to hiring and developing and training up new staff. So it's a win-win for all concerned. And then on to skills. So, you know, while Ireland performs relatively well in terms of skills development among young people, a comparatively small share of the adult population performs well on all levels of the PIAAC, the Programme for the International Assessment of Adult Competencies. So managing the digital transformation in the labour market and that shift to a green economy that we've spoken about requires investment in human capital and a well-trained and a very skilled general workforce at all levels. However, our performance on digital skills is quite concerning. Over 55% of the population have either low or basic digital skills. The skills that are easiest to automate or to outsource are routine technical skills. Educational success is now about creative solutions and critical approaches to problem solving and decision making and persuasion, to applying the knowledge that we have to different situations. It's about the capacity to live in this multifaceted world as an active and engaged citizen. A 2019 report from the OECD found that the digital transformation could compound existing socioeconomic inequalities, with the benefits in terms of earnings and opportunities accruing to a few, and then the risks falling more heavily on people with lower levels of education and skills. And this seems to constantly be the way. The report notes that 14% of all jobs are at high risk of being lost due to automation, with another 32% at risk of significant change over the next 10 to 20 years. So essentially what that means is that nearly half of the labour force will be impacted by changes to their jobs because of automation by 2040. So our training and our skills development policies have to be adapted to meet that very significant challenge. Moving on then to health. One of the most obvious concerns about the Irish healthcare system, setting aside the pandemic, is to do with access. Ireland's health system ranked 22nd out of 35 countries in 2018, according to the Health Consumer Powerhouse report that was published the following year in 2019. But on the issue of accessibility, Ireland ranked worst. The report notes that even if the waiting list target of 18 months were reached, it would still be the worst waiting time situation in Europe. And that's a piece of data that just blows my mind. We're so far away from reaching that target. And even then, even if we reached our own goal, we'd still have the worst waiting time in Europe. Irish hospitals are working near full capacity, and the occupancy rate for acute care beds is among the highest in the OECD countries. And you can see that here in this graph. While having a high utilization rate of hospital beds can be a sign that the hospital is efficient, it can also mean that too many patients are being treated at the secondary care level rather than primary care. And we know for a fact that Ireland is among one of the lowest countries in terms of its primary healthcare provision. By comparison with other OECD countries, the share of the Irish population delaying or foregoing care is comparatively high. It's above 30%. So that means people are delaying much needed treatment because of the lack of spaces and the lack of capacity for the healthcare system to take them on. Moving on then to waiting lists. So Ireland's, you know, complex two-tier system for access to public hospital care means that private patients have a speedier access to both diagnostics and treatment, while those in the public system can spend very lengthy periods of time waiting for a first appointment with a specialist or for treatment. The official statistics suggest that 628,756 people were waiting for an outpatient appointment in March 2021, while 35,634 were waiting for treatment as an inpatient or a day case. The COVID-19 pandemic may obviously have contributed to the numbers on the waiting lists. However, as we can see in this table, there have been very high numbers on waiting lists for many years. As I said, those waiting on outpatients appointments last March numbered almost 630,000, an increase of 16,180 on November last year. And both the 2020 and the March 2021 figures represent very large increases over the figure at the end of 2014. Those waiting 18 months plus numbered 178,064. And that's the target we're trying to reduce in March 2021. And that's up from just under 157,000 in November 2020. The number waiting for inpatient appointments at 35,634 in March 2021 was less than half the number of the previous November, however. Before the onset of COVID, the Irish public hospital system was already operating under pressure from high population growth and ageing. And because of system cuts to bed capacity in the preceding decades, this is set to continue. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the insufficient preparation of countries to cope with major public health emergencies, Ireland included. Certain groups obviously will continue to experience health difficulties and will need particular policy focus, and inequalities still need to be addressed as disparities such as in life expectancy continue to be great between socioeconomic groups. So there was mention of Roma communities. There's, you know, we also know in terms of traveller communities, they have a very low life expectancy, and we really need to have targeted measures to address this. Moving down to taxation. government decisions to raise or reduce overall taxation revenue needs to be linked to the demands on its resources. These demands depend on what government is required to address or decides to do. The effects of the economic crisis a decade ago and the way it was handled also carry significant implications for our future taxation needs. The rapid increase in our national debt, driven by the need to borrow both to replace disappearing tax revenues and to fund emergency investments in the failing commercial banks, has increased the ongoing annual costs that are associated with servicing the national debt. Similarly, the need for the state to rescue or support so many aspects of the economy and society during the pandemic has triggered large-scale borrowing, so future liabilities to both service and repay this debt. The Department of Finance has used the European Commission 2018 ageing report as the basis for its assumptions from 2020 to 2070, which are summarised here in this slide. The report anticipates an increase in the older population, so those aged 65 years plus, from approximately 712,000 people in 2020 to 1.2 million in 2040, and to a peak of 1.49 million in 2060. Over that same period, the proportion of those of working age will decline as a percentage of the population, and the old age dependency ratio will increase from almost 5 people of working age for every older person today to less than 3 for every older person from 2040 onwards. So while these increases imply a range of necessary policy initiatives in the decades to come, there is an inevitability that an overall higher level of taxation will have to be collected if we want to pay for those much needed age-related supports. We believe that there is merit in developing a tax package that places less emphasis on taxing people and organisations for their valuable work and their enterprise, or on the value that they add and what they contribute to the common good, but rather to tax people and organisations based on the value they subtract by their use of common resources. So there was mention there of Mariana Mazzucato's work in terms of looking at how R&D has gone towards kind of private enterprises. And this is certainly something that needs to be brought into discussions around taxation. Whatever changes are made should also be guided by the need to build a fairer taxation system, one which adheres to the core policy objective of collecting sufficient tax to ensure full participation in society for all through a fair tax system in which those who have more pay more, while those who have less pay less. So how do we go about doing all of that? Seems simple enough, I suppose. In Social Justice Ireland, we believe that every person has 7 core rights that need to be part of the vision for the future. So they have the right to sufficient income and to live life with dignity, the right to meaningful work, the right to appropriate accommodation, the right to relevant education, the right to essential healthcare, the right to real participation, and the right to cultural respect. And these are themes that Hugh touched on in his presentation in terms of how you might actually deliver on that. For these 7 rights to be vindicated, greater public expenditure to fund a broader provision of services is much needed. So in that respect, as part of a new social contract, government should ensure that future tax and spending policy is focused on building up Ireland's social infrastructure, prioritising areas such as healthcare, social housing, education, childcare and early education facilities. And we did a large piece on this last year in relation to the social contract, and our annual policy conference last year was dedicated to this theme. These are areas in particular where Ireland is experiencing an infrastructure deficit. Without adequate future planning for the kinds of social infrastructure and services we need, it won't be possible to maintain, never mind improve, the current standards of living for all citizens, from children to older people. Once COVID-19 has been defeated, all countries will face major challenge to decide if the experience of the last 20 or so months and our response to it should shape the future of our society. We must learn from this experience and tackle the inequality and exclusion that we failed to address up to now. What we see clearly now is that the healthcare services that struggled in normal times have been provided with significant additional resources that we were told couldn't even be considered prior to the pandemic. What was claimed to be impossible before now seems to be the only sensible course of action. All that suggests is that there is something profoundly wrong with our social contract. Once COVID-19 has been addressed successfully, it's crucial that we face up to those radical reforms that are needed if we're to reverse that prevailing thrust of policymaking over the past four decades, which has failed to eliminate the inequality and exclusion that mires our society. To achieve the vision set out, Social Justice Ireland has proposed a policy framework for a new social contract that identifies five key policy outcomes and sets out key areas for action within each. We need the investment in infrastructure and services to develop a thriving economy. We need taxation to fund this. We need good governance to ensure that people have a say in shaping the decisions that impact them. And we also need to ensure that everything that is done is sustainable, environmentally, economically, and socially. Each of these five key policy outcomes must be achieved if we're to deliver a more just and sustainable society. It's not enough that three or four out of the five might be achieved while neglecting the other areas. All five must be worked on simultaneously. It's not a question of getting the economy right and everything else will follow, because we've seen that approach tried and fail. This has to end. So we've looked at how our rights under the social contract are currently being realised or otherwise in the areas of income, work, education and healthcare. So let's look at some potential policy alternatives in those areas. Firstly, to prioritise investment. Large-scale investment programmes are desperately needed to ensure a sustainable and inclusive recovery from the current crisis, which operates in jobs-intensive areas and assists growth, as well as social and infrastructural deficits. The focus would need to be tailored to each individual country or region, but might include the development of renewable energy sources, health and social care infrastructure, housing, education, and early childhood care infrastructure. We need to implement the European Pillar of Social Rights, as we've discussed today. We need to establish processes involving social partners and civil society partners to implement the pillar in ways that are legally binding and that aim for equal opportunities and access to the labour market, fair working conditions and social protection and inclusion. We need to strengthen our welfare system. Government needs to introduce social protection schemes that are far more resilient and that tackle inequalities within the present systems, ensuring that there is equal access to services and to strengthen social cohesion. The national minimum wage must be replaced over time with the living wage to ensure that we are providing that floor for people who are in work. We need to adopt effective labour market measures, so activation measures in the wake of the pandemic, which focus on supporting unemployed people, aiming to maintain and develop appropriate skills and to not be accompanied by the threatened loss of welfare benefits or assistance. We need employment measures that are not implemented in a way that removes income security and increases in-work poverty. We need to tackle low pay by supporting the living wage and by moving towards a basic income system. We need to start to tackle low-paid employment by supporting the widespread adoption of the living wage, including giving public recognition to organisations, including small and medium enterprises, that commit to paying the living wage and to consider moving towards a basic income system. We need to develop sustainable approaches to taxation and increase the tax take. Sustainable and inclusive growth requires approaches to raising revenue that generate enough to support the vital services and to move to a social investment approach. Measures should not disproportionately negatively affect low-income groups, and that means, amongst other things, avoiding increases in indirect taxes on essential items. We need to tackle tax evasion and the grey economy, which are a particular problem in some countries, and certainly, you know, tax avoidance measures here are a particular issue. Tax evasion must be tackled and fair taxation systems introduced in which all sectors of society, including the corporate sector, contribute a fair share and those who can afford do pay more. We need to consider how government can become an employer of last resort. So given the ongoing impact of unemployment, governments in badly affected countries should consider being an employer of last resort through voluntary programmes framed so as not to distort the market economy. We need to ensure inclusive governance and promote social dialogue. engage with key stakeholders to ensure that groups at risk of poverty and social inclusion and unemployed people can influence policy direction and implementation, and that their experiences become part of the dialogue with national and European institutions to try and repair social cohesion and political legitimacy. We have seen the damage that is wrought by policies and legislation that is drafted without the relevant stakeholders. It is doomed to fail. We need poverty proofing and monitoring. All government decisions should be subject to a poverty proofing process that ensures that actions taken won't increase poverty under any heading or cumulatively impact negatively on any particular group. We need to integrate social assessments of the impacts of policy changes into decision-making processes that focus beyond the short-term cost savings and use macroeconomic modelling processes to assess the impact of proposed changes in social policies. We need to avail of the social investment aspects of the programming of EU funds to fund measures that address the social situation, including supports for initiatives set out in the EU's social investment package, such as supporting social enterprises or facilitating the implementation of the recommendations on investing in children. And we need to commit to appropriate regional strategies that ensure that investment is balanced between regions, with due regard to sub-regional areas, aiming to ensure that rural development policy is underpinned by goals of social, economic, and environmental well-being. We saw reports during the pandemic of people starting to move from urban areas out to towns and more rural areas. But that, if it's to be sustainable into the long term, requires investment to make sure that there is an economic activity to sustain those communities. Now is the time for creative thinking about what society should look like when the pandemic has passed. Business as usual is not acceptable, and delivering the leadership required demands that implementation of that citizen engage citizens, foster trust, and build a more just society. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. I hope you found it useful. If you have any ideas, any conversations that you'd like us to have, please feel free to email us at secretary@socialjustice.ie. Until next time, stay safe.